Zionist aggression in Gaza.
Bush's Middle East tour.
Political deadlock in Lebanon.
Guantanamo 6 years on.
Zionist Israeli tanks and helicopters raided the Gaza Strip last week, martyring the son of Hamas leader Mahmoud Zahar and at least 30 other Palestinians. Zahar's other son was also martyred after a botched Israeli assassination attempt against the Hamas leader in his home 3 years ago. The deaths came while the U.S. president was still in Saudi Arabia begging for higher OPEC production quotas and yet more U.S. arms deals following his evidently futile high-profile trip to occupied Palestine to bring peace and nationhood. At the morgue at Shifa Hospital, Mahmoud Zahar held his lifeless son's head in his hands and closed his eyes, then kissed him 3 times on the forehead and recited a verse from the Holy Quran. Mahmoud Abbas condemned Israel's actions as a massacre, a slaughter, and warned that they would not bring peace. His government spokesman, Nabil Abu Rodena, said these brutal acts weaken the position of the Palestinian negotiator, in addition to harming the peace process. The Zionist act of aggression took place only a day after its negotiators and Palestinian Authority officials began talks on the main issues in the conflict: borders, Jewish settlements, Al-Quds, and Palestinian diaspora. The democratically elected Hamas government rejects the U.S.-sponsored talks along with preconditions attached obliging Palestinians to officially recognize Israel. George Bush was in occupied Palestine only a few days ago, pledging tens of billions of dollars to the Zionist entity so it would stop its daily murder of Palestinians for at least the duration of Bush's Middle East so-called peace visit. But the Zionists took the U.S. money, attacked Gaza, and continued to construct their illegal settlements. The Zionist entity is out of control in its orgy of murder and mayhem against occupied Palestine, to the extent where it would not even cease its massacre of Palestinians while Israel's mentor Bush is still in the region. What does that say about the disparity between schizophrenic Zionist practices of gesturing for peace and posturing for genocide? Perhaps the Zionist regime can start its victory celebrations now, should the Arabs fail to unite very soon in order to anticipate the Zionist entity's future moves, should the international community fail to act within the next 6 months against expansion of Zionist settlements and the outlawed separation barrier building practices, and should the Palestinian Authority itself remain divided. There will only ever be peace in Palestine state. The world of Islam unites behind the Palestinian cause with verve and courage, rejecting half-hearted efforts witnessed so far inside fast-disappearing occupied Palestinian lands.
With the U.S. President's tour of the Middle East and the Persian Gulf coming to an end, it's time to ask the question, what if anything has been achieved? Has his presence brought peace in the Middle East out of the shadows and into the realm of possibility? The answer is definitely no. But what has reemerged is the awful specter of war with Iran, which many thought had disappeared after the publication of a U.S. National Intelligence estimate indicating Iran is not seeking nuclear weapons. There's no doubt Bush did some tough talking during the early stage of his trip, which began in Israel. He made no bonus about calling Israel's post-1967 occupation of Palestinian and Arab lands just that, occupation. And he certainly took Israel to task for neglecting to dismantle outposts. Strangely enough, he met with little opposition from either Israeli politicians or the media, either because in their heart of hearts, they knew the president's rhetoric was expressly designed to fall like milk and honey onto Arab ears, or more likely because they were too busy filling his ears about the perceived threat from Tehran. Bush got that message. All right. Luckily for him, there was an incident in the Straits of Hormuz which proved how dangerous the Iranians really are. Luckily again, the US Navy had three evil pranks on tape which they superimposed with a menacing voice. The incident served as an opportunate entree for the president's anti-Iranian drive. First, he sent out a strain of warning to Tehran, and then he told his Persian Gulf hosts in no uncertain terms that Iran is the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism and must be confronted before it's too late. But Bush's luck ran out when the Iranians put out their own video of the supposed face-off. This version showed a rather polite exchange whereby an Iranian crew member asks for the coordinates of an American vessel and receives a courteous response to the effect the U.S. ships were in international waters. This prompted the Pentagon to admit it had superimposed the creepy voice on their tape and that their voice's owner may not have been Iranian. Such U.S. belligerence puts his regional hosts in rather a pickle, as they have already decided to bring Iran back into the fold and were even more set on doing so following the publication of the National Security Estimate that stamped Iran as benign on the nuclear front. Bush says he wants nothing more than a viable Palestinian state and Middle East peace before he leaves office. But could it be that what he wants a whole lot more is a weakened Tehran and a friendless Iran? The president may fly away with a wide, self-satisfied grin, but in the same way he has given little of substance for future Middle East peace, methinks he has received little of substance to further his own plans vis-a-vis Iran. There is one thing crystal clear, though. The neoconservative agenda is alive and well.
The Lebanese presidential election was postponed for the 12th time, indicating that the chasm between the country's political groups is still wide. Although the Arab League's three-point plan is considered the only solution to the current crisis in Lebanon, it will actually provide an opportunity for the opposing parties to continue their confrontation. Foreign ministers of Arab League member states adopted a plan in their recent meeting in Cairo, which proposed that Lebanese Army Chief General Michel Soleiman should be elected as the country's president. The second point of the plan suggests the establishment of a national unity government in which the ruling March 14 group would receive almost half of the cabinet seats. The plan sets aside one-third of the seats in the cabinet for the opposition March 8 group, led by Michel Aoun, and the rest of the ministers are to be independents. The third point of the Arab League plan emphasizes the need to revise the electoral law of Lebanon's constitution so that the country will not face problems in future presidential elections. Although the March 14 group, which is led by Al-Mustaqbal faction leader Saad Hariri, and the March 8 group, which consists of a number of Maronite Christian figures and factions plus Hezbollah and Amal, have basically agreed that Soleiman should be the next president, the issue of establishing a national unity government is still being disputed. The government envisioned in the plan has certain ambiguities which are preventing the March 14 and March 8 groups from reaching a consensus. Arab League Chief Musa went to Beirut to personally supervise implementation of the plan and talk to Lebanese leaders, but went home empty-handed and will definitely face difficulties in the future because there is no other venue which can help implement the plan. Now it appears that the crisis over electing Suleiman as president is coming to an end, but the issue of the cabinet's configuration still remains a major challenge facing all political groups in Lebanon. If a solution to the problem of the composition of the cabinet is not found before the presidential election, then Lebanon will definitely have no administration for a long time, and this is apparently what the March 14 group wants. Endless wrangling about the cabinet's makeup will only intensify the problem of the political vacuum in Lebanon. To solve the crisis, a cabinet must be formed that is not biased in favor of either side and is only concerned about the country's national interests.
January 11 marked the 6-year anniversary of the establishment of the Guantanamo detention camp. On the 6th anniversary of the Guantanamo Bay, protesters took to the streets worldwide, with over 80 people arrested in the U.S. capital. Around 200 demonstrators in prison-style orange jumpsuit marched from Congress in Washington, D.C. to the nearby Supreme Court building, calling for the shutdown of the prison where the U.S. military put terrorist suspects in detention. In addition, a petition signed by 1,100 parliamentarians from across the world and 100,000 other signatures from U.S. citizens was to be handed in to the White House. People also staged protests in Philippines, Sweden, Paraguay, Bahrain, Ireland, the United Kingdom, and Greece. Mere months after the start of the 2001 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, a large cargo plane landed in a U.S. military base in Cuba's Guantanamo Bay, bringing in a group of hunchbacked, orange-clad, blindfolded terrorist suspects, apparently representing the worst of the worst. But the fact is that Guantanamo is neither a warranted compound holding bad people, nor is it a dark spot in the otherwise luminous U.S. record for respecting human rights, rules of war, and international treaties. If anything, Guantanamo is a mere extension of a long list of untold violations practiced by the Bush administration, which condenses the camp to bring a symbol of widespread policy predicated on casually undermining international law. The prison is perhaps one of the worst mockeries of international law, which was itself drafted partly by American legal experts. Past U.S. administrations may not have been devoted followers of the Geneva Conventions, but neither have they ever discarded international treaties as openly and as arrogantly as the current one. The chances are, if the Guantanamo prisoners were of any value, whatever information some of them might have possessed has already been extracted, violently or otherwise. Moreover, if overwhelming evidence against them was indeed at hand, the Bush administration would have tried them long ago. Despite all the criticism, Guantanamo is staying in business for the exact same reason that the war in Iraq rages on, and for similar reasons to why the Bush administration's failing global policy persists. Shutting down Guantanamo would be an admission of defeat, a declaration of failure, which is something that the partisans of the empire cannot afford, at least not now. Indeed, Guantanamo is a dark spot in U.S. history and shall go down in world history as a symbol of injustice and oppression. And it will continue to be a jarring reminder of the inhumanity, the torture, and the extreme violence associated with the Bush administration's so-called war on terror.